Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, a health and environmental journalist, and I contribute to the Huffington Post and Alternet, as well as my own website, healthjournalistblog.com. Every week here on the Progressive Radio Network, I bring you shows that discuss the relationship between our personal health and our total health environment. When I began this program, Connect the Dots, several years back, people weren't seeing the connection as much as people are today, and I'm really glad that this program and the experts and writers and thought leaders that I bring here have been part of a greater movement to trace these connections and raise awareness about the fact that what we do to our environment, what we allow in our communities and societies, the way we interact with our neighbors and those near and far has profound impact on our personal health and on the health of our society and planet Earth, which is the habitat we rely upon for life. So every week on Connect the Dots, I bring in different thought leaders to make different aspects of that connection for you so that we can also both be aware, make personal choices, but also make social and collective choices, taking action where needed to assure that society expresses health-centric values. I've done a great deal of coverage on this show of environmental concerns. Past guests have included Helen Caldicott, Harvey Wasserman, Greg Palast, Larry Schweiger, and a whole host of prominent fractivists. As well, and I cover fracking a great deal. We're doing another environmental show today. We've had representatives from 350.org on the program, from Green Festival. You can check in the Connect the Dots archives for past programs and make sure to like us on iTunes. On today's show, we're going international, I'm happy to say, and our guest today is speaking to us from Canada, and I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating to learn the parallels and unfortunate similarities, and in some cases some of the differences between how companies' energetic search for more energy is taking place in a way that undermines both environmental and health resources, as well as the social contract between people and government, which has existed and that we trust and work hard to sustain in order to live in a democracy, in a democratic society, with the care for individuals and the freedoms that that reflects. Of course, I'm speaking to you now as this show is running live, and it's just a couple of days after the presidential inauguration. And as I've discussed with our guests on the show many times, even the word environment was largely lacking and absent in the presidential campaign and debates, but it's come back in full force in the inaugural address, and it's our job here in the U.S., if we care about the environment, to join with like-minded organizations such as the ones that I featured on this show to assure that environmental concerns and initiatives advance at the rapid rate we need them to address climate change as well as our energy needs. So we'll find out, because, you know, there can be national lines drawn between nations. There can be lines drawn between states, between communities. But, you know, the Earth isn't subdivided that way. And what travels from one place goes to another. And that's why I'm really glad to welcome today's guest. Her name is Carrie Saxifrage, and she is a reporter and a lawyer, an environmental lawyer, and a journalist. She's recently completed a book for the Vancouver Observer, to which she is a regular contributor, and she's also at work on another book project, which we'll ask about a little later in the show. Her book is called Extract, The Pipeline Wars, and so she'll be discussing with us today tar sands and its exploration and exploitation from a Canadian perspective, even though she's an American. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Carrie.
Thank you, Allison. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. You know, so test tell our, you know, we haven't actually, I've done some blogging on Huffington on tar sands, but we haven't done a lot of Connect the Dots shows. I think this is probably our first show on tar sands and the pipeline. You know, for those who've been hiding on a rock and don't know what tar sands is, can you kind of just give us an introductory explanation of that in the pipeline, and then we can get more specific about the Enbridge pipeline?
Sure. I would love to do that, because this is really an area where Canada and the United States are in it together. Canada has huge reserves that are known as the tar sands or the oil sands, depending on who's speaking. And it's basically a very heavy form of oil that's mixed with a lot of sand, and it's underneath the boreal or northern forest of Canada up in Alberta. And to access the tar sands, the companies pretty much chop off the top, they call it the overburden, the forest, and then they have machinery, you know, the biggest households, to scrape out the sand. They do some preliminary refining that turns it into something called bitumen, which is, if you were to see it, it would be a bit like asphalt, not something that you can put in a in a pipeline. So they add natural gas condensate, so it's maybe 70% bitumen and 30% this natural gas condensate, put it into the pipeline. And the I think the thing that I really hope people will understand about the tar sands is the massive amount of fossil fuel reserves there are there. With the tar sands projects that are already approved, that if those get fully developed, then that puts us on the path to 6 degrees increase in global temperatures, which is what is considered the catastrophic amount of climate change, catastrophic being, you know, not enough fresh water, displacement of people, famines. I'm sure you've talked about climate change. It's, you know, it's mm-hmm. really a terrifying prospect. And already all of the projects in the tar sands altogether now are enough to get us to the 2 degree, which is considered more or less safe, the 2 degree increase in temperatures. So, you know, this is according to climate scientist James Hansen, and if all of the tar sands oil gets exploited, in his words, game over for the planet. So basically what we have is a huge petroleum resource that even groups like the International Energy Agency are starting to say need to stay in the ground for climate stability. But there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure from the oil companies, which have so much money and power. And then also in Canada from the federal government, Prime Minister Harper is from Alberta, which is what we call the oil patch, and has a lot of industry connections. And Bill McKibben actually has called the Canadian federal government a subsidiary of the oil industry, because they've been working quite forcefully on the behalf of the oil industry to create markets for the pipelines. And right now there's two major pipelines that go to the U.S. One is the Enbridge mainline, and the other one is called the Kinder Morgan Express. So already the United States is receiving about 13% of its imports from Canadian oil. One of the other problems with the oil sands is that when it's produced, it creates a lot more climate pollution. So, and the wells-to-wheels life cycle analysis by the U.S. Department of Energy, that means from the time it gets taken out of the ground to the time it gets burnt in your car, the tar sands oil creates 22% more climate pollution. So say you have a Honda Accord and it's burning tar sands gasoline, it's just the same climate impact as if you're driving a Chevy Suburban. So, you know, I think there's a shared interest the world over in really getting a plan in place so that the tar sands aren't exploited to the extent that it's game over for the climate, which pretty much means no expansion starting now. And these pipelines are all about expansion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess in terms of the forward movement of this, you know, is it the eagerness for energy? Is it people being sold on a bill of goods by these industries and the government? Does climate denial play a role? You know, what do you think are the, you know, kind of the top factors why this is going ahead, given, you know, what you're describing?
Well, you know, I think the oil companies are really running business to a great degree. And in terms of the Enbridge pipeline, which would go from Alberta across the Rocky Mountains to a port town called Kitimat on the BC coast, they call it a discount per barrel of oil. When Canada exports its oil to the U.S., they don't get as good of a price because all of the pipelines go sort of to the Midwest where there's a glut of oil. And if that same oil goes to Asian markets, they can make $15 to $30 per barrel about more. And with regards to climate denial, it's really interesting how climate just is not a part of the discussion, the pipeline discussion. Right now, the Enbridge pipeline is undergoing agency reviews, and climate change is actually outside of the terms of reference for the agency. They can't consider any of the cumulative impacts of the climate damage enabled by the pipeline. You know, unlike here in the U.S., you know, the State Department has to do an environmental impact statement for the Keystone Pipeline, and the EPA has said that they need to consider all of the climate damage that that pipeline will enable. So Canada is behind the U.S. there, and, you know, and I really think that it has to do with the huge financial interests at stake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So basically, they're not taking that into account at all. I mean, I think a lot of environmentally aware and literate people that I know feel that not enough is being done here, or the right people aren't sitting, you know, doing the right kinds of science with the right, you know, the appropriate support and time frame they need. But there is at least in some cases some slight lip service. But we see this a lot. I think there's a sense in the public that, the government will be handling this. It couldn't happen without that. But, in fact, there are gaps. And you're saying that major gaps. You're saying that the gaps are actually even more, acute in Canada.
Well, I hate to be the one to bring this news because, like you said, I immigrated to Canada about 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Prime Minister Chrétien was in office and Bush was in office in the States, and it really felt sort of like Western Europe but with an incredible natural environment. And
mm-hmm.
And things have changed a lot, and the Harper government is actually not only denying the science, but he has actually muzzled the federal scientists. In March 2010, he said that they were not allowed to talk to the press without going through his cabinet. So, you know, it really sort of is a war on science up here, on climate science. And another aspect of that is that we have, you know, BC is just amazing. The glaciers receded 10,000 years ago, and the First Nations people came in and they started to inhabit that land, and salmon came into the rivers, and there's huge rivers that go into the interior of BC with gigantic salmon runs.
Mm-hmm.
And the First Nations people and the salmon and these colossal forests that were really nourished by those giant salmon runs,
mm-hmm.
all flourished together over the last 10,000 and it's very rugged country. It's very inaccessible where the pipeline and the tankers would go. And it's really the last place like this on mm-hmm. Earth, last huge expanse of global temperate rainforest. and it was, I think it was 2006, it was actually protected by the federal government, the provincial government of BC, and a lot of foundations putting their money together so that the First Nations who lived there and the logging companies and the environmentalists could agree on having an area that was truly ecosystem-based management and sustainable forestry. And this area is called the Great Bear Rainforest. It's an incredible tourist destination. Mm. It's, you know, the people, the First Nations who live there still eat from the sea. It's really an amazing place.
Mm.
So those American foundations that helped with this, in the last year, Stephen Harper started calling them foreign interest groups and accusing them of opposing, of funding Canadian groups to oppose the pipeline so that the U.S. would keep getting cheap oil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are institutions that fund, you know, Amazon work, universities, scientific institutions. They're really the world's most respected science-based foundations, and Harper pretty much started to vilify them, the federal government did, and he pulled funding from a planning process they were involved in for the waters of the Great Bear Rainforest and actually designated that money to the Canada Revenue Agency so that they could start investigating these foundations and groups in Canada to make sure that they weren't engaging in political activities. So Harper is really quite aggressive and toward the, you know, the science-based institutions and towards science itself. Sort of goes beyond denial here.
Wow. It's actual, I mean, near persecution or something like that, really.
Well, in the book extract, it has a letter by Environmental Resources Minister Joe Oliver, which actually calls people who oppose the Enbridge pipeline radicals and says that they're trying to sabotage the national interest.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it couldn't be clearer.
Mm.
It's really quite it's quite unfortunate. And Zipporah Berman, one of our great Canadian activists, she did the afterword to the book extract.
Mm-hmm.
And her point is that Canadians really deserve to have a reasoned debate about these major infrastructure projects because they have huge risks and they lock us into particular energy and economic pathways.
Mm-hmm.
And the Harper government is really acting in an anti-democratic way by trying to stifle that debate.
Making unilateral decisions and really suppressing the science and the organizations that represent a different view. How conscious and mobilized about this is the Canadian citizenry, in your opinion?
Well, I can speak for BC, and BC is very conscious and very mobilized. And and really, you know, one of the big differences between Canada and the U.S., or BC and the U.S., is that there aren't treaties with the First Nations, what you would call the Native Canadians. There were no treaties, and their traditional territory really extends over all of BC. And you know, it hasn't been an issue because it's so remote and so inaccessible. But more and more, these huge energy infrastructure projects are coming onto traditional territory, and the First Nations actually have an unceded, they call it Aboriginal title, the land. And so they have tremendous power, and they're exercising that power, and there's been incredible leadership by the First Nations and a lot of bridge building between the First Nations and the non-Native communities. And, for example, 130 First Nations have signed something called the Save the Fraser Declaration, which basically says, and the coastal group of First Nations has signed a similar declaration that say, no pipelines in their traditional territory and no tankers. And, you know, since their traditional territory is so much of BC, it's really a deal breaker, and the Harper government is going to have to either push through, although, you know, they have a constitutional right to these claims, or he's going to have to, the legal terminology here is consult and accommodate their interests. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the First Nations think that there's no way to accommodate their interests. If there's an oil spill into one of their food salmon-bearing rivers, you know, that just doesn't get cleaned up. And this is a 10,000-year relationship with single area of land. If people's creation myths are right there in their traditional territories, and their ancestors are buried there, and their form of governance is so different than, you know, our private property ideas. Their governance really arises out of their relationship to their traditional territory. It's very alive and well, and they're absolute leaders in this, and, you know, it really puts the Harper government in a difficult position, because he'll be facing the litigation from the First Nations if there's approval of the Enbridge pipeline in particular.
So they still have sort of a legal standing to do this kind of standing up for the earth.
They do. It's like it's like the Idle No More movement,
yes.
writ small, because the, you know, Harper made big changes to the Indian Act, which kind of negotiates the relationship between the First Nations and the federal government without consultation. And he made huge changes to the Fisheries Act, which used to cover all fish in all waterways, and now it covers commercial fish in only certain waterways, which, you know, scientists have written letters to him and said, it doesn't work that way. The non-commercial fish feed the other fish, like it's all connected. But the First Nations really see, with the pressure of development projects, that they stand to lose it all, and that's really at the heart of the Idle No More movement.
Well, you may not, in moving to Canada 18 years ago, have, you know, kind of found the happy oasis you were seeking, but you certainly have found yourself in the midst of a very interesting nexus around environmental concerns. You know, I just was looking on Facebook, and someone who has a substantial following was saying, gosh, you know, because of Occupy Sandy, and I did several shows about that, both with people doing relief work as well as those commenting on the wake-up call for environmental concerns and all, but somebody was online saying, gosh, you know, what are the exit routes from New York? Where would fresh food come from? You know, and there still is this, you know, pioneering myth or fantasy that, you know, we could go somewhere that would be perfect where, you know, we could quietly grow our vegetables if there's huge social breakdown. And, you know, I wrote into that thread and said, well, this is why a group of people have been opposing, you know, trying to get a ban against fracking in New York State, because to protect the water and food supply of the city, you know. And so now you have, you know, a few people kind of waking up down in the city. Of course, there are many awake down in New York City about this issue, but this thought leader was not among them. And, you know, and still sort of seeking, calling oneself spiritual, but still seeking the individual escape and oasis. So I think, you know, I think your experience is a wonderful, wonderfully captures, you know, the fact that there is no utopia to be found if you run off to escape the, or try to escape the downside risks of our social policies that we've allowed to foment, you know, without really aggressively organizing against them. But on the other hand, there is much work to be done wherever one goes.
Yeah, I think people in New York are really right to start considering the impacts on food and water, and I'm sure that Hurricane Sandy was a huge wake-up call. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, I actually, my husband and I did move to a little island to grow vegetables, and now, you know, that under the threat of being logged. So I think we're just at the point where our connections to what supports us are more tenuous in the cities, and the places that are unspoiled are, you know, the remnants coming under intense industrial pressure, and it makes for a very interesting time. And when, you know, I appreciate a radio show that really encourages people to wake up to the, you know, actually the physical challenges. And I know there's a lot of spiritual challenges in life, but you know, to really apply those to what's happening in a physical way, the land, I think, is so important. And, you know, and that's another inspiration of the First Nations of BC, where their, you know, their culture and their practices are really all about respect for where they're from. Like, their stories are about, you know, a salmon person coming into the village and intermarrying, and so the river, they have a sort of familial respect for the salmon, and that you know, requires them to look at the rivers in an entirely different way. So, you know, it's very interesting in how our worldview can impact how we treat the earth.
So, you know, so there in Canada with the First Nations empowered, you really have exposure to not only the problem side but also the solution side in terms of a kind of integrated collective paradigm that, you know, that is well established within their culture and not just something that someone cooked up yesterday to do a five-step advice book about or something.
I would call it the legal right, because I think the power is actually in the hands of the people who are well financed. And the First Nations, you know, in Canada, there were residential schools, and you know, just a real out and out attempt to destroy the cultural ties to family land. And so, you know, I don't think that First Nations feel very empowered. I think they feel like their plate is full with just trying to get their kids healthy adulthood and things like that. You know, that's a generalization, but many people. And they're also recognizing that they do have, you know, the legal rights and that that's a form of power, but financially it's a very imbalanced situation, like oil companies versus the First Nations. It's not really even there at all.
Well, and the other imbalance that we talk about a lot on this show, which maybe we can discuss in the second half hour because we're kind of coming into our break pretty soon, but is the, you know, some of those industry dollars go toward PR. And so there has been here in the States, and maybe it's not true up there, because I see this really high-quality effort that you've done in the book Extract, which, you know, was published by the Vancouver Observer, you know, a newspaper up there. You know, here there's been an erosion of journalism. It's been replaced by PR to a large degree, and there are numbers and studies that document that all of that. And so therefore, you know, it's kind of PR statements rather than substantive analysis, investigation, and all the rest of it. I just saw online something that said, you know, get a journalism degree, specialty PR, you know, and you know, PR is fine and needed, but when you have multi-billion-dollar, trillion-dollar companies spending millions on PR to assert that a practice is safe, necessary, to lobby government officials, you know, or have, you know, maybe backdoor deals with them, even, who knows, you know, then the messages and the information that people receive will be tainted. One of the things, I was very impressed with your book in that, you know, you were reporting from going deep into these various communities to go to oil industry meetings, to go to, you know, activist meetings, to go into nature. You know, you really did, were able to do, through the support of a journalistic outlet, the real investigation and get the human side and the human texture of these events. And so, you know, possibly journalism is alive and well in Canada. What's your view on that?
So Enbridge has a $5 million PR budget, and Extract is largely a labor of love. It's, you know, the fruit of an Indiegogo campaign and a few generous individuals, and we, at this point, I would just really like people to I'd like to urge people to actually buy the book and read it, because it's a very fluid and engaging way to get a handle of what's going on in Canada, which is huge and has big impacts for the U.S. in terms of the tar sands. And, you know, journalism, truly independent journalism, evidence-based journalism, desperately needs support in Canada as well as in the U.S. You know, there's a big concentration of ownership of newspapers,
mm-hmm.
and the Vancouver Observer, you know, it won the award for the best Canadian newspaper with a circulation of under 500,000, and really it does that on a shoestring and a kiss, and
mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same struggle, and the editor of the Vancouver Observer, Linda Solomon, is just so committed to really keeping independent voices alive and well in BC, and she's done an incredible job, and, you know, it's a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that much different, and, you know, and buying the book is a great way to get engaged in.
Okay, we're coming up on our break now, so when we come back from our break, why don't you just quickly tell people where they can find the book, and then we'll go into the break.
Okay, just go to Amazon and type in Enbridge Extract, or go to the Vancouver Observer, Google the Vancouver Observer.
Okay, well, that's good for now. We'll mention it again in the second half of the hour. We have to kind of go into our break, but I wanted listeners in this half hour, please stay with us. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we've been talking about the tar sands, oil extraction and pipeline from the Canadian side of the border with author and environmental lawyer Carrie Saxifrage, the author of Extract, The Pipeline Wars. And she's really been filling us in the first half of the show all about the Canadian context, as well as really has in-depth knowledge of tar sands and pipelines from an environmental perspective. If you missed the first half of the show, I urge you to go and listen in the Connect the Dots archive. Rate us on iTunes, and you'll also find there a whole range of programs on health, the environment, and society. Just at the end of the first half hour, we were discussing the really incredible journalistic effort and work of investigation that went into Carrie's amazing book, Extract, The Pipeline Wars. And the thing that really impressed me was not only your depth of knowledge and analysis, Carrie, but, you know, the texture of the book and your ability to go out into the field and travel all over the place to really make the story come alive. And that's so important. We had discussed the fact that journalistic outlets, true investigation of the kind that you undertake in this book and that you undertake in your work for the Vancouver Observer is really becoming rarer and rarer nowadays. And people expect journalism to be there. But, you know, what we have more and more is a lot of industry-funded PR as well as recycling, focused but limited, short attention span stories rather than the kind of in-depth analysis you did here. So I just wanted to, as we were doing at the end of the show when we kind of heard the music coming up for a half-hour break, highlight where, how and where people can go to support independent journalism in Canada and as well as to get a copy of your book. So first you were saying at the end of the show they can find Extract, The Pipeline Wars on Amazon through searching for it. You can go to www.vancouverobserver.com/contribute. And that's the way that you can make a contribution to the kinds of real investigative coverage, which takes time, effort, elbow grease, travel budgets, and all the rest of it. You know, as a reporter myself, I can tell you, you know, people are always wanting reporters to cover this and to cover that. There's a sense of desperation. There are many David and Goliath struggles where, powerful multinational entities with you know, huge budgets are, you know, kind of wielding their power and getting the last word through media control, you know, over, you know, small, local, grassroots, native, or just even ordinary citizen concerns. And so there's, you know, it's kind of the task of the journalist to tell those stories, but it's a dying art, and you know, with a you know, kind of a crumbling and overwhelmed business model. So you know, people will be like, as a journalist, I can say this, will be cover this, cover that. Do you know about this? Do you know about that? But there has to be a cycle of give back as well, or it won't be there. So I really encourage listeners to support that in Canada, as well as on other online sites that seek your contribution to do their reporting. So once again, VancouverObserver.com/contribute. Do it today. So let's return to our discussion of the Canadian tar sands and the attendant pipelines. You know, one of the things, Carrie, that struck me was that you were saying that actually, you know, the promise when governments come in and say, you know, we're going to build this pipeline, we're going to exploit and extract from these tar sands, we're going to do the fracking, we're going to build a pipeline to carry the natural gas. The promise is of for energy independence here. You know, the sense is your oil bill is going up at your home, your gas bill for your car, you know, to keep our countries running, you know, we need to do this. And yet the reality is that this is actually being sent abroad because the money for the industries in question is better. So we're actually kind of third worldizing this continent and taking, you know, its resources in a way that's damaging planet-wide, earth-wide. But, you know, the promise, which is this is going to bring you energy, so go along with the governments that do this, but, you know, but the reality is actually this energy is being exported. And that's so for natural gas as well. You know, what you're describing is it's going to be shipped out on tankers. And of course, that immediately calls to mind, you know, the Exxon Valdez tragedy. Can you tell our listeners who may be unacquainted a little bit about that, you know?
Sure. And just with regards to what you were saying, I so agree with what you're saying about journalism and with regards to oil in independence. And the economic growth from oil infrastructure. In Canada, the oil companies are now 71% foreign-owned. Mm. And actually, we share this, the Koch brothers apparently, or Koch brothers apparently, are responsible for 25% of the export from the tar sands, and they're, one of their subsidiaries is largely behind the Keystone pipeline. And there's just huge claims that are based on, you know, economists have looked at Enbridge's claims about economic benefit, and they're erroneous and misleading, but they are absolutely pervasive on the airwaves. You can't turn on a television or a radio station without hearing about jobs and growth and how much it has to offer us. And so, you know, here in BC, was, you know, it's really a large externalization of costs. And one of those, as you mentioned, is the risk of a tanker accident. And boy, Exxon Valdez, it happened 23 years ago. There's still, you know, some of the seabirds may not come back. Some of the forage fish may not come back. One of the killer whale pods is dying out. You know, 250,000 seabirds died. 3,000 sea otters died. The Alaskan natives had huge issues from watching that much death of wildlife. And, you know, there was depression.
That's traumatic for them because they care.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's, you know, there really is this sense of a existing chain generation to generation that's responsible for the land. And so, you know, it's devastating to be the generation that represents a break in that duty of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it just goes on and on how devastating that was. You know, also for the commercial fishing communities up there, and the seas in BC are some of the worst in the world, with names like Hecate Strait and Dixon Entrance, and these, the strongest winds of Canada are at the southern tip of Haida Gwaii, which is an archipelago that the tankers would have to go past, and you know, there's hazardous tidal conditions, and if you look at a map, there's just so many rocky islets, and it's, the channel out of Kitimat is extremely narrow and dangerous. And at the Vancouver Observer, we actually had four different master mariners call us and say, you know, we looked at the website and the Enbridge's description of the dangers are just, they're just not true. You know, they compare it to Norway's North Sea, but the storms are bigger off the coast of BC, and the safety requirements in the North Sea are far superior. That's up in Norway. The anchors off of BC would be much larger. It'd be eight times the size of the tanker that created the Exxon Valdez spill. And the federal government just defunded the Coast Guard, so actually the Coast Guard's presence is going to be less than more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, controversially, Enbridge put out a big piece of PR about the tanker route where it showed a map that actually removed all the islands and made it look like, you know, clear sailing all the way out. And
wow.
When I was up on Haida Gwaii, this archipelago where the Haida Nation has had its home since, you know, time immemorial, I spoke to the vice president of the Haida Nation, and she was, you know, she said, the ferry gets stopped, boats don't run. Like, this is a frequent occurrence all through the winter. Like, boats just don't go. And to have big tankers in these extremely hazardous conditions is just, it just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Another Haida counselor said that just the water that washes off of these huge tankers from the deck surface will enter the food supply. And there's this place called Rose Spit where when there's a big storm in the winter, these huge scallops, like if you put your two hands together, they're that big. They just wash up in masses on Rose Spit. And this is actually the place where in myth the Haida climbed out of the clamshell with the encouragement of the raven. So this is where their creation story is, and this is where they get a lot of their food, and the tankers would go right past that. And, you know, the prospect of that is just devastating, and the Haida will, I'm sure, they were sort of the, you know, the bad warriors of the coast, not bad, but, like, powerful. And the people who went and took slaves from the other First Nations and that sort of thing. And, you know, they're warriors, and they don't want it because it really would just sever them from their sense of responsibility. And something else is that, you know, there's a lot of subsistence eating. We call it subsistence, but you can't actually buy seafood that good. But people, you know, cost $60 to buy chicken for a family of four on Haida Gwaii.
Mm-hmm.
And people just don't have that kind of cash economy, and they truly do live from the fisheries and the shellfish and the clam openings and the seaweed and the berries. You know, when the strawberries come ripe on Rose Spit, everybody goes out there. So, you know, that's just one of the First Nations. There's also the Gitgat. You know, they estimate $2 million in subsistence food from the Gitgat host. And there's just a lot of First Nations that will lose everything. And in their view, it's not if there's a spill, it's when there's a spill.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, you know, Enbridge has been asked point blank during these regulatory hearings whether they will promise to cover all the costs of a cleanup, and they refuse to make that promise.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an externalization of risk to the First Nations in particular, and the taxpayers who would foot the bill as well. You know, it's come out that, their insurance coverage, I think it's $575 million, well, this is for the pipeline, $575 million for a pipeline spill, but the Kalamazoo spill, for which they were responsible, has already been $765 million in cleanup costs, and, you know, 30 miles of the river are still closed out of 39 that were polluted.
Let's talk a little bit about those spills, because one of the things I think that also happens is, you know, typically extractions occur, you know, out of sight, out of mind of where the majority of the population resides, you know, whether they're leveling a forest or it's happening in a food agricultural area that people in urban environments have a kind of sense of disconnect from. You know, but the pipelines actually can go anywhere, and there are multiple examples. In fact, my most recent piece on AlterNet, for anyone who wants to look for it, is on a pipeline and compressor station that's going, scheduled to go right through the center of a town where a lot of 911 survivors, firemen and police, reside. This is on AlterNet, where I report. But, you know, and so one of the things people don't realize when they, again, have their, you know, dream of going back to nature or whatever, is that these pipelines kind of crisscross and go everywhere. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the pipeline dangers, you know, as you looked into that issue?
Sure. And this applies to the tanker, too. One of the problems is that it's diluted bitumen. Like I mentioned, 30% mm-hmm. gas condensate and then 70% this bitumen, which is really heavy. Mm-hmm. So if it's a tanker spill or a pipeline spill, the bitumen isn't like oil. So the oil booms that they have used or tried to use, you know, like in the Gulf and places like that, mm-hmm. this bitumen can't be boomed because it just sinks. And then meanwhile, the natural gas condensate evaporates, and, you know, in the area of Kalamazoo, it made people severely ill, and mm-hmm. it killed the wildlife, and, that in itself caused ecological devastation. But Enbridge, you know, it's a 20,000-barrel spill, and companies can only capture a quarter or less of the oil spilled, and 1 liter of spilled oil can contaminate 1 million liters of groundwater. And the thing about the Kalamazoo spill is that the pipeline ruptured occurred, and it took Enbridge 17 hours to become aware. And, you know, there's the transcripts from their pipeline control room where they can block off the pipelines in the event of a spill, and their shift changes, and people are like, oh, that couldn't be a spill, and, you know, we'll hand it over to the next guy. And, you know, like, really it shows a true culture of indifference to what happened. And the U.S. Transportation Board just lambasted them, called it a Keystone Cop situation, and the oil spill wasn't actually discovered until somebody flew over and noticed it. So you know, like, these are not the sort of cautious, alert protectors of communities from spills. And the Enbridge pipeline, as I meant, the Northern Gateway pipeline would go through the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, I sat there in Kitimat with a couple of elders from the Haisla Nation, and it was a blizzard. It was just so much snow, and one of the elders said, you know, look at that out there. There's no aircraft that would be going over that pipeline. If there is a spill, there's no way that you could get people up in there. Like, it just can't happen. And the pipeline would go across three of the major river systems of North America, the Mackenzie, the Skeena, and the Fraser. Mm. They said these are deep river systems where the salmon come up, and they really nourish the entire inland of BC, and it would go over 700 rivers. Many of them have slope instability and that kind of thing. And you know, the First Nations with the traditional territory, I talked with this one wonderful Wet'suwet'en woman right next to this waterfall where her people have dip netted salmon, like these huge salmon that are jumping up a waterfall that's maybe, you know, 15 feet high, and they reach with the nets and get them. And, and he said, you know, if the pipeline goes right along the spawning ground for these salmon for 34 kilometers in this area where there's, you know, the logs and the river structure that the salmon fry and the salmon eggs really need. And if there was a spill there, we wouldn't have salmon. And she just shook her head and said, you know, I just could not fathom a life without salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the bonding issue for people in the north. It's the First Nations, it's the commercial fishery, it's the sports fisheries. And a city councilor at Prince Rupert said to me, you know, when it comes to salmon, everybody checks their baggage at the door, because there's lots of debates about allocation of salmon, and the runs are decreasing. They're still strong, but they are decreasing. And she said, you know, like, everybody just checked their baggage at the door, and we're all marching in the streets together against this pipeline.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, because, you know, there you have salmon as a kind of binding of nourishment and force in you know, communities in that region.
Yeah.
But also salmon is shipped and exported, and with the, you know, the Gulf oil spill and all the rest of it, some of the Gulf and Atlantic seafood, you know, was contaminated and isn't safe to eat. So even, you know, far away on the eastern seaboard of the United States, you know, people are still, you know, haven't tuned, you know, they're still looking for Canadian or Alaskan salmon or something. You know, if they're smart, they are. Otherwise, they're just eating whatever, you know, the restaurant serves without asking where it came from. You know, and even though that's a kind of specialty, sort of First Nation problem, you know, to kind of where's our salmon going to come from? It, you know, it just shows the reach of how these things, you know, can reach different people. And also this and other foodstuffs can be at risk to go away, you know, and that's something, you know, we're accustomed to there being there, we're accustomed to having gas, we're accustomed to this and we're accustomed to that, but any of it, including the earth's the stable earth ecology, can and is going away. We're coming down to the end of the show. I want to thank you so much, Carrie Saxifrage, for being with us, author of Extract the Pipeline Wars, on today's Connect the Dots. Listeners, please do go and get your own copy of this fantastic book at www.vancouverobserver.com or on Amazon. Thank you, Carrie, for being with us. It's been a great conversation. So happy to have you on the show.
Allison, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And listeners, thank you for being with us this week on this edition of Connect the Dots. Please check out our Connect the Dots archives, where we have many wonderful conversations with many caring thought leaders like Carrie. And come and listen to us next week, every 10 a.m. on Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.